A few winding roads took her to her destination, the third largest government building in the Washington area behind the Pentagon and the U.S. Capitol, the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency. NGA is one of America's 16 intelligence agencies under the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, and certainly one of the least well-known. Formerly the National Imagery and Mapping Agency, NGA is dual-hatted as a combat support agency for the Department of Defense, as well as being a member of the U.S. intelligence community. The agency was only a few years old, but tremendous resources had been poured into this facility and another massive building in St. Louis. The organization received $5 billion a year in federal funds and employed thousands of personnel, both military and civilian. After showing her badge to a guard and then running it over a scanner, she put her purse on a table for inspection and went through a metal detector. A long walk down a hallway with other employees, about a third of whom wore military uniforms, took her to a down escalator, above which ran the motto of the organization written out high on the wall. Know the earth. Show the way. Understand the world. She passed into the massive atrium of the building. She'd read somewhere you could lay the Statue of Liberty on its side in here, and she scanned her badge at a reader in front of one of a half dozen glass doorways in the center of the room that led to a bank of elevators. She took a ride to the fourth floor, then crossed the suspended hall over the atrium, made her way down another corridor, and scanned her badge a fourth time to get into her small office. Annette was an imagery specialist for the NGA. She spent her days looking over all types of pictures using imagery manipulation and enhancement software, as well as compiling and analyzing other bits of data. Then she wrote interpretive reports of what she found, and these were delivered to the NGA's mission partners, policymakers, war fighters, and first responders. Although she recognized her work wasn't going to change the world, she found it interesting nonetheless, and she took solace in the fact she was damn good at it. Annette had spent her entire adult life focused on intelligence. After a full career in Army intel, she had gotten hired here as a civilian analyst. She loved her work, and her colleagues, and the mission itself. As fractured and stressful as her home life was, she was, after all, a widow with a teenage daughter with issues. Brawley took comfort in the fact she could come here every day, devote herself totally to the imagery and data points of a faraway place she would never visit personally, and build a coherent picture about what was going on there that just might help her country in some small way. Her office was in the East Asia Department, and her focus was North Korea, and while most of the others in her office spent their time on the sexy stuff, fixated on either the opaque and mysterious government there or the nuclear and missile programs, Annette Brawley was in the economic section, and she concentrated almost exclusively on the DPRK's mining industry. She'd become an expert on mining not out of any love for digging up rocks, but for the simple fact that she was tasked to North Korea's economic sector, and that was their principal industry. NGA geospatial technology was much more than looking at pictures and maps. The agency used all manner of data, space-borne, airborne, seaborne, and landborne intelligence platforms at their disposal, as well as pulling the activity on cell phone towers and even social media. But much of that didn't apply in North Korea. NGA had little to no visibility on cell phone data inside the Hermit Kingdom, and social media there was banned. But there were other geospatial analysis tools at her disposal. Satellite photos and videos ferried out of the country by smugglers and defectors. Even government propaganda information could be gleaned to find hidden nuggets of information. This morning she decided she'd take a look at some new images from one of the National Reconnaissance Office's KH-12 satellites. She pulled up the files on one of the three 27-inch monitors in front of her and oriented herself with the global positioning information on the data screen next to it. She spent a few minutes looking at a road project to a tungsten mine just outside Pyongyang, saw that nothing much had changed since she'd last looked in on the location a month earlier, and she noted it in her log. Then she typed in the coordinates to the Chungju rare earth mineral mine. A year earlier, she had spent virtually all her time watching activities at the Chungju mineral mine. But that was when the Chinese were there, when there was real development going on. America's policymakers were interested back then, because rumors out of China said the deposit in the mountain there could have amounted to trillions of dollars for North Korea. This was something that worried the U.S. government, so Annette had worked long hours tracking the progress on the site. She'd discovered small amounts of ore, just a few rail cars, traveling north from the open-pit mine to the Chinese border, presumably for processing at one of China's rare earth refineries. When the Chinese were thrown out, Annette had received an intel briefing from the CIA that suggested they left because North Korean leader Choi invalidated their mining contract. Interest in the mine quickly waned. Everyone concluded that the North Koreans wouldn't be able to do much more than continue to dig a small amount of ore out of the rocks and then ship it up to China for processing. Through her own work, she determined the mine would reach only about 4% of its yearly production output capability without help from the Chinese. When Chungju went on life support, she refocused her attention on other mines in other parts of the DPRK, but she circled back every month or so to peek in on the sat images over Chungju. Each time she had done this over the past year, she saw that the North Koreans were still trying to get something out of the site, but it was a shell of the operation it had been when they were partnered with those who knew what the hell they were doing. Looking over the newest digital images from the KH-12 satellite, Brawley was happy to see there were no clouds over the site. The KH-12 sat had radar imagery capability as well, but this wasn't the same as looking directly at the site through an optical lens. She scanned the images the way she always did, slowly and methodically. First, she ignored the buildings around the mine and focused directly on the open pit gouged out of the mountainside. The resolution of the KH-12 satellite cameras was fantastic. She could make out bulldozers and other earth-moving equipment. She even saw individual men, their shadows a further indication of what a clear day it was. But nothing much was going on in the pit, so she began scanning to the south. The small city of Chungju was here, a few kilometers from the site itself, and she always liked to take a look at the train station and the freight storage lots nearby to see if it looked like there was any new industrial or commercial activity anywhere in the town that might relate to the mine. This morning, she saw something immediately. "That's odd," she said to herself. 16 rectangles were lined up in a parking lot next to the one low and squat hotel near the train station. She never would have noticed the anomaly in the middle of the town if not for the fact she'd spent something in the neighborhood of 200 hours looking at images of Chungju a year earlier, and her mind was programmed to burn images into it. She knew the layout of the town even now. Certainly not every building, as there were hundreds, but the main clusters of development. These rectangles hadn't been there even last month. She would pull up the older images to double-check, but she was too sure of herself and too curious to do that now. She knew what the rectangles were, because they were a common sight at mines and construction locations. They were portable buildings, like those used for temporary site offices or modular temp housing. Laid out as they were here, in neat rows lined up alongside the one hotel in the city and the train station, she knew this was housing brought in by the government for non-resident workers. She could tell these were housing structures also, because she saw a cluster of small outbuildings around an open pit fire and recognized it as a crude food preparation facility. 16 temporary buildings like these could house, Annette knew, 150 or more workers. But workers for what? There were a few factories in Chungju, but nothing that large. The only heavy industry around here was the mine. She scanned back up to the mine. There was no major operation going on there, neither digging on the mine nor construction on other structures around it. She looked all over the city again, hunting for any signs that some new building or massive new statue of the Daewansu was going up. When that turned up nothing, she scanned the roads around the town, and then the railroad tracks, trying her best to find any new project that would employ 150 workers. It took her an hour to do this, but at the end of that hour, she had nothing to show for it. But Annette Brawley had learned to be dogged and driven in the army, and she had learned the nuances of her craft in intelligence school. She knew she was onto something, so she kept at it. In a country like North Korea, where a lot of military activity takes place underground to stay hidden from satellites, she began to suspect she had uncovered something to do with the missile industry. The Sohae satellite launching station was on a small peninsula jutting out into Korea Bay, just 25 miles to the southwest. Just maybe there was an underground secret project going on all the way over here. It didn't track with anything she knew about how the North Koreans operated, but she decided she'd talk to her colleagues in her analytical group who spent their days fixated on Sohae and get their take on it. She was just about to break for lunch, a little frustrated that she felt like she'd wasted 2 hours on a futile hunt, when a thought occurred to her. There was a hydroelectric dam west of the Chungju mine, probably no more than 10 minutes' drive on the paved roads in the area. It was an hour away from where the temp housing was located, but still she wondered if perhaps the guest workers were doing some refurbishing on the dam there. She had to pull away from the enlarged image on her monitor to find the general area of the dam, and then she zoomed back in. She scanned along the dam, looked for any sign work was going on, but again, she found nothing. Shit. It was the last large structure in the area she could recall. Without thinking, she moved the image around to the left and the right, tracing around the banks of the reservoir created by the hydroelectric dam. There was a tiny village of square buildings on the north bank of the reservoir, and then she panned left to the west bank, on the far side of the water from the dam. She stopped panning and leaned her face halfway to her monitor. What the hell is that? A series of long metal roofs ran on either side of some sort of raised track. On the eastern side of the roofs were a series of circular structures. Annette thought they looked like some sort of tanks. She counted 26 individual structures in the entire complex, and several vehicles were parked nearby. No freaking way. She thought she knew what she was looking at, but to be certain, she spun in her chair to the monitor on her right, typed something in a Google search, and then pulled up an image. This was the LAMP site in Malaysia. LAMP stood for Linus Advanced Materials Plant. It was a rare earth mineral refinery owned by the Australian mining company Linus. She looked back to the location near the reservoir in the mountains of North Korea, and then back to LAMP. The two sites were virtually identical. "What are you doing out there in the middle of nowhere?" she asked aloud. She typed something on her keyboard, and her third monitor displayed schematics of a typical rare earth refinery. Within a minute, she had identified the round tanks as part of a rare earth oxide separation unit. That confirmed it for her. North Korea was back in the rare earth mining game, and in a big way. They were cutting the Chinese out, even from the processing stage of the equation. That would require high-tech equipment, and massive amounts of expertise and skilled labor. And Annette didn't think for one second that the North Koreans were doing this on their own. Annette Brawley had worked through lunch, running down to one of the two cafeterias in the atrium only to grab a banana and a bag of animal crackers. She ate while she worked, compiling her astonishing findings and creating a quick but impactful PowerPoint presentation. In Army intelligence, her main weapon had been the PowerPoint slideshow. It garnered a lot of insults from the soldiers devoted to combat operations, and rightly so, she admitted. She wasn't a shooter or a door kicker. She was an intel geek. But even though the door kickers she presented her slideshows to sometimes rolled their eyes, she took solace in the fact she'd done her best, and her best had helped the troops in harm's way. Annette's superior at NGA was a Marine colonel named Mike Peters. He was younger than Annette by a few years, and she found him roguishly handsome, and even though sometimes she felt he deferred unfairly to her colleagues in the armed services at the expense of his civilian employees, he did seem to appreciate Annette for her hard work and the lack of drama she brought to the workplace, as compared with some of her younger colleagues, both in uniform and out. She rapped on the door to his office at 3:30 in the afternoon. She'd checked his online agenda and saw he had a half hour till his next appointment. Peters looked up from his paperwork. "Hey, Brawley, what's up?" "I've got something good. You have 10 minutes?"
"Got more than that. There's a meeting on 5 at 1600, but I'm yours till then."
If only, she thought. She pulled up her PowerPoint on his computer and sent it to a monitor on the far wall of his office. They went through it together over the next 10 minutes. She showed her boss the temporary housing in Chongju near the hotel, new cars parked throughout the town, and then finally the processing plant near the dam north of Chongju. When it was finished, Colonel Peters turned away from the monitor and back to her. "So the Chinese companies, Chinalco and Minmetals, are back at Chongju, and they're going to process their ore? Why would they need to do that?"
"They wouldn't. The Chinese have their own refineries over the border, and the roads, rail, and bridges to get it there."
"What's your conclusion?" he asked.
"The only conclusion I can come up with is that the Chinese are not involved."
"Are you saying the DPRK domestic mining operation is developed to the extent they can extract rare earths?"
Brawley shook her head. She considered herself a pretty meat-and-potatoes analyst. She didn't speculate wildly about anything, because that was a surefire way to make errors. Still, when she was sure of herself, she expressed herself with vehemence.
"Mike, I've been examining operations at this mine long enough to know this isn't DPRK doing this work alone. They are getting help."
"Who is doing the work?"
"That's going to be impossible to tell from a satellite. CIA needs to get a man in there."
Peters laughed. "Have they been showing Mission Impossible in the break room or something?" Brawley laughed as well.
"Sorry, is that far-fetched?"
"I don't know, Humint. I just look at roofs and heads. It's up to somebody else to get all the answers on the ground."
Peters liked Brawley's work. She was careful, more careful than many of the 20-somethings that worked at her level. "This is good."
"Thanks."
"This might go all the way up to DNI. Who knows, it could make its way into the presidential daily brief." Brawley's eyes widened. She had a smiling picture of President Jack Ryan on her desk. Even the fans of the president in her office teased her about it. "Maybe I should work up another PowerPoint. More levels of distinction. More color." Peters shook his head. "Everyone in the IC knows Jack Ryan likes to look at raw data for himself, but DNI Foley won't sit in the Oval with him and click through a PowerPoint. Don't worry about your presentation. You've done great work. Now get back to your office and produce something more."
"Something more?" You aren't done, Annette. He tapped the open-pit mine with the tip of his pen. As long as they keep digging, you keep digging. Colonel Peters gave her a satisfied wink.
Just thought that one up, Colonel Peters? Or have you been saving that one for a while?
Just thought it up, he said proudly. Though you can expect me to reuse it hundreds of times. It's pretty good, right?
Chapter 14. 1 year earlier. Mining Director Huang had met Intelligence Chief Reed just once, a week earlier when he showed up unannounced to his office, and at that time Reed had been wearing his military uniform. Huang supposed the Lieutenant General was always dressed as an officer in the Chosun Imingun when he left his house, so Huang found it surprising to see the 52-year-old this morning wearing a light gray western suit and a blue tie. Huang had to admit that Ri was, if anything, even more impressive out of uniform. He obviously exercised regularly, unlike Huang, who rarely seemed to find the time for evening walks with his family, and often got winded taking the stairs to his office of the Korea Natural Resources Trading Corporation. The two men stood in front of each other in the business class lounge at Pyongyang Sunan International Airport. Each man had his own small entourage with him. In Ri's case, it was colonels as well as bodyguards, and in Huang's case, a single personal attendant, as well as several assistant directors and high-level technical advisors. It was just 5 a.m., and the first commercial flight of the day wasn't leaving until 8:30, so the military and government men had the place all to themselves, although General Ri could have shut down the entire airport if he had any concern about eyes on him that might threaten today's operation. Director Huang Min-ho still could not believe he was leaving his country, even if it was just for 24 hours. Virtually no regular North Koreans ever set foot abroad, and even very few high-level government officials earned the opportunity. North Korea is as close to a closed society as exists in the world, and the government-imposed sheltering of its people from the outside world was a key component to the nation's ability to control the message to its citizens. But Ri had orchestrated this trip. He'd arranged the travel for Huang and himself, and a total of 9 of their translators and assistants, and he'd smoothed out the highly unusual situation with the Ministry of People's Security. A nation that regards unauthorized departure as an act of treason punishable by death clearly took foreign travel seriously, so Ri and his office had a lot of hoops to jump through to make this all happen. He forced his way through much of the bureaucracy by invoking the fact he was on an approved operation of the Daewon Su. He had, in fact, gone as high as Choi's office to get approval for the travel, and only after a few days of meetings with security men, meetings where General Ri and Director Huang were asked personal questions to vet their commitment to the Supreme Leader, were they finally allowed the opportunity to go abroad, and only then in the presence of several domestic security agents posing as subordinates. In Huang's case, it was a truly rare occurrence that such a high-ranking mineral executive would fly out of North Korea without being part of some sort of organized delegation replete with state security officials sent along to watch over him, lest he either be kidnapped by the West or, and all knew this would be more likely, attempt defection. And as uncommon as it was for Huang to travel abroad, the fact that General Ri was outside North Korea at all was utterly unheard of. But Ri made it happen. The men were supremely motivated by the threat to their own lives if this operation did not succeed. Ergo, the men had torn up the rule book. After a call came through the radio of an airport official, the entire group filed down a back stairwell of the terminal to ground level. Then they took a rickety bus ride out to a TU-134 twin-engine jet painted in the red, white, and blue markings of Air Koryo, North Korea's national carrier.
Huang felt his legs shaking as he climbed the jet stairs. It was not from excitement. This was no thrill that he was getting to visit outside his country. This was real fear. He'd lived 54 years hearing stories about the outside world, all of them bad. There was a statue in his hometown showing American GIs spearing a screaming Korean baby with a bayonet. Foreigners were evil, and the disease and rampant crime and moral and physical decay of South Korea and Japan were legendary. He had spent the evening before holding his wife and children, fighting back tears, and telling them to be strong and have faith in the Daewonsu should he never return. On board, he had his choice of seats. The plane could accommodate up to 80, and there were only 16 on the flight. He strapped himself in next to Ri and sat silently, his hands trembling, thinking about the prospect of what he would face when they landed. They took off toward the south, and the aircraft climbed into the morning fog, and Huang did little more than nod as Ri began discussing his strategy for the meeting later in the day. 4 hours later, Huang was deep into his work and past the terror of the unknowns of the trip. He barely looked up from his paperwork as the aircraft landed in Vientiane, Laos, to refuel and to obfuscate the origin of the flight. Within half an hour, they were back in the air. They landed a second time in Singapore during a mid-afternoon rain shower, and here they were met by local operatives of Ri's intelligence service and driven to the Mandarin Oriental Hotel. Huang Minho could not believe his eyes when he saw the opulence and grandeur of the lobby. As one of a rare few of his countrymen who had actually seen the inner sanctum of residence number 55, he could say without reservation that this hotel was even more luxurious than the palace of the Daewonsu. As confused as he was by the riches on display, available apparently to regular businessmen and not just to government elite or royalty, he noticed Ri felt the same way. He could tell by the wide eyes and sideways glances of the general that he had never seen anything like this either. Neither man remarked on the amazing facility as they took an elevator up to the presidential suite. At their sides were domestic security agents, and both men knew they were being watched to see how they reacted. In the hallway on the top floor of the hotel, 4 physically fit men in suits greeted the entourage from North Korea. The translator for the Huang Ri group, a middle-aged North Korean woman, spoke in English to the men, and then everyone stepped into the 2,500-square-foot presidential suite. Huang and Ri both smiled at the sight of the man they'd come all this way to meet. Oscar Robles de Mota cut an impressive figure. 73 years old and heavy-set, he was nonetheless surprisingly fit, and his hair dye, though fooling no one, at least gave him the appearance of vibrancy. He stood a head higher than Ri, and even taller than Huang, and he wore a beautiful black 3-piece suit from Savile Row. He stood at the floor-to-ceiling windows, but spun toward his guests and walked to them with an energetic spring in his step. He spoke with an air of unbridled competence and power, introducing himself to both men as if they were fans in line for an autograph, instead of two of the most important officers of a nuclear power. But that was Robles's way. Some successful men never do develop personalities fitting of their accomplishments, but Oscar Robles was a winner, and he damn well knew it. Robles was the 3rd wealthiest man in Mexico and ranked number 28 on the Forbes list, with personal and familial assets to the tune of $24 billion. He didn't start out with nothing, though the narrative his company propagated had pushed that history for the past 35 years. The truth was that his family made its money in copper mining going back 3 generations. The Robles family company, Grupo Pacifico, still mined copper and zinc throughout the nation, but they'd made money in oil, leasing land for drilling across Mexico, and then Oscar Robles had created exponential growth for himself by expanding to mineral mines around the world by using offshore companies and limited partnerships.
He owned or had owned dozens of mineral mines on all points on the globe. Part of a titanium mine in Mozambique, diamond mines in Botswana and Sierra Leone, gold, copper, zinc, and nickel mines in a dozen countries. With his vast wealth, he had the ability to create companies and even banking institutions out of thin air to keep the money trails of his endeavors hidden. Huang knew of Robles because Robles had partnered on North Korean mines in the past, albeit on a scale a small fraction of what Huang would propose at today's meeting. The men all sat down at a large conference table brought up to the presidential suite just for the meeting, and after one of the North Korean state security men scanned the room for listening devices with a small apparatus, Robles began the conversation with an uncomfortable question that was conveyed first in English and then in Korean through the translator. "And how is former director Kim?" Robles asked. "I enjoyed working with him in years past on the Magnesite project in Daejeon. I found him to be a capable man. Mr. Huang, I understand you replaced him as director of Korea Natural Resources Trading due to ill health." Huang paused for a moment, unsure as to what he should say. A state security minder sent along to watch the meeting sat on a sofa, away from the conference table, and stared stone-faced back at him. "Yes," Huang replied to the translator, who converted his words effortlessly into English. "He has taken ill, but he will recover. The rigors of the job, however, are too much for him now, so he will tend to his beautiful garden and enjoy his large and happy family." Robles nodded without smiling. "I understand." Huang had a strong suspicion the Mexican did, in fact, understand quite well. He had been working on mining ventures in North Korea for decades. It would come as no surprise to him that a level of treachery such as that perpetrated by Director Kim would be dealt with quite harshly by the leadership. With that matter settled, Director Huang Min-ho spent the next hour laying out his proposal to restart the Cheongju rare earth mineral mine without the partnership of the Chinese. He explained how General Ri would help him acquire some of the technology and information necessary, but that they would need an initial investment of hard currency and the support structure of a foreign partnership to obtain everything they needed to get the mine up and running. Robles listened politely, but with markedly little animation. Government mining ministers came to him asking for help on a regular basis. Only the month before, a Congolese minister approached him to partner on a new iron mine in his nation. Robles declined. His own geologists doubted the size of the find, and he wasn't impressed with the returns at his other Congolese mines. The North Koreans had talked him into coming all the way to Asia to meet with them, assuring him they had an opportunity he would not want to pass up. Of course, he knew this would involve the rare earth mine recently vacated by the Chinese, and, of course, he was interested. He had his finger on the pulse of the world mining community, so there was no way a find like Cheongju would slip by him. He knew the Chinese had wanted to stay, but Choi had forced them out, and Robles was curious enough to fly to Singapore and sit with the little brainwashed fools from North Korea to see what they wanted to offer him. He was ready to invest, to move mountains, both literally and figuratively, if and only if the North Koreans could show him that the value of the mine and the terms of their contract offer both made the deal worthwhile. Huang showed him the raw findings of the Chinese, all translated into English, and Oscar Robles could not believe his eyes. He knew the North Koreans were sitting on a rare earth reserve large enough that the Chinese had been fighting to keep a partnership going despite Choi's actions,
but the assertion that $12 trillion at today's value lay just beneath the rocks was nothing less than astounding to the Mexican. He asked for clarification on various matters, but Huang had been ready for this. He had the numbers from the tests and the CVs of the geologists who signed off on the find. Robles then said something that surprised both Huang and Ri. "I am interested, but as a businessman, I like to know what I am getting into. I haven't been to your country in over 20 years. If I am going to invest in this project of yours, I want to see it." Huang was confused at first. "All of the findings of the Chinese are in the materials here. You may feel free to take your time in looking..." The running translation was interrupted when Robles said, "No. I want to go to North Korea and see the merchandise. The mine. The location of the proposed processing plant, the infrastructure you have in place now. If I like what I see, if I agree the potential is there and the terms of our partnership are to my liking, then we will do business together." Huang replied, "Certainly. When would you like to come?" "I suppose you have a plane at the airport now. I'd like to return with you tonight."
"Tonight?"
"Yes. If I don't come now, if you make me wait a week or a month, then you will have time to put some window dressing up at the mine, to reroute the electricity, or to take generators out of Pyongyang and truck them to the mountains just for my visit, to move every skilled miner in the nation to Chongju, and to put them in a new uniform made just for my visit. I have been at this a long time, amigos. I know all the tricks." Huang started to balk, but General Ri, who had been silent for the vast majority of the meeting, stood suddenly. With the air of a military man, he said, "Let us not delay." Even though the reception committee had less than 12 hours to put something together, in Pyongyang, Oscar Robles was treated like a visiting head of state, although no cameras recorded his arrival. He met a cavalcade of senior officials at a private residence set up for visiting dignitaries, and they promised their full cooperation should he enter into partnership on Chongju. Robles's other mining concern in North Korea had been a profitable exercise for him, and he found the North Koreans had held up their end of the bargain, so he was positively inclined to agree even before he headed up to Chongju. The following morning, they took off to the north in a long motorcade. Robles sat with Ri and Huang in a military SUV. They were silent on much of the journey. All that needed to be said had already been said, and there was little for the big Mexican to do but see for himself. Robles spent the day at the mine and the proposed location of the processing facility a few kilometers to the west of the pit itself. He walked the scoured earth, his patent leather shoes covered in mud and gravel. He knelt and held the dirt in his fingers. Finally, he smiled at Huang and Ri. "Not so different from the Sierra Madre." They smiled back. Over the next 2 months, Robles sat in his Mexico City office and worked in secret with his senior staff, ironing out just what was necessary to assemble a rare earth mining operation from next to nothing. Everything from how much water would be brought in to the list of United Nations sanctions that would have to be skirted for the operation to be successful. He worked closely with Huang and his senior staff, and he worked with Ri as well, directing the head of North Korea's Foreign Intelligence Service in the drawing up of a battle plan of how to facilitate the successful mining operation. The terms offered by Huang were curious, but Robles found them to be acceptable. There would be a huge capital outlay early on, of course, as Robles deposited millions of dollars into North Korean offshore accounts. This was an initial cash buy-in that was a lot of money for the North Koreans, but nothing much for Robles at all. Then Robles would use his own funds to move equipment and personnel into North Korea. This would cost, Robles estimated, well north of $60 million. He'd been told about Choi's demand that production begin in a year and a half, and this was a tight timeline, but the $12 trillion buried under the dirt gave Robles the incentive to get it up and running. The third major outlay for Robles would be the largest. The day production began at the mineral processing facility, he would owe the North Koreans a one-time cash payment of $500 million. A lot of money, to be sure, especially after his other expenses, but after this, the contractual terms were firmly in Robles' favor. He'd recoup his expenses in under 5 years, and he'd have so much pure profit after that, his main concern would be on how to rake in and launder it all. It was clear to the Mexican businessman that the North Koreans wanted the contract front-loaded to their advantage because they needed an infusion of cash. Robles did not know why, nor did he ask. He knew theirs was a dirt-poor nation, and he hoped his money would go to improve the lives of the common people in North Korea. But he highly doubted this. He wondered if they would blow it all on luxury items and nuclear missiles. But he wondered this for only a moment, because he really didn't care all that much. Robles intended to keep his name out of the entire affair. It would appear to the world, if they found out about it at all, as if North Korea itself had played the world mining industry like a Stradivarius, orchestrating the movement of manpower, brain power, machine, and natural resources, bringing everything together. Many would assume the DPRK had outside help, but on this venture, just as in other operations Robles had undertaken in less permissive parts of the world, he would conduct his part of the business in secret. In the lists and charts and white papers created by his staff about the hardships of bringing this plan to life, nothing appeared as a more obvious problem than the processing of the ore. Robles and Huang could build the mine and extract the ore, and once the ore was refined, Robles could assist the North Koreans in getting it onto the world market in a way to maximize its value. But the highly technical and intensive processing of the minerals was beyond even the scope of Robles and his Grupo Pacifico. A few mines around the world did their own processing, but only in the United States, China, and Canada. Even the Australians sent their ore to an Australian operation based in Malaysia to be processed. But that would not work for the North Koreans. They would have to do it themselves, right there at the mine. This was yet another crucial matter that he'd have to bring up with Duke Sharps. Robles's Grupo Pacifico had relied on the work of Duke Sharps in New York City for much of its underhanded corporate espionage and investigations in the past decade, so it was a simple matter to contract with Sharps again. The full scope of the North Korean operation was laid out to Sharps by Robles himself at a luxury hotel in St. Martin. The American ex-spy agreed on the spot, as soon as Robles agreed on a cost-plus fee for the private intelligence firm. Sharps charged an incredible amount of money for the work he did. Often the brash American infuriated Oscar Robles by his near-extortionate fees and his occasional reluctance to get his hands really dirty. Sharps would spy. He would break some laws, and he would push some boundaries, but a man in Robles's line of work occasionally needed extreme measures taken, and Sharps was too above board to do the real dirty work. But Sharps and his people had their place. They would help get foreign nationals into North Korea. They would help move material and steal proprietary software needed for the production facility. They would pressure elected officials and UN members to vote the way the North Koreans desired to keep the money and the material moving. In the final analysis, even though Duke charged too much and refused to assassinate, kidnap, or beat Robles's enemies, The businessman in Oscar Oblast knew that Duke Sharps and his staff were worth every damn cent.
Chapter 15. Present Day. John Clark's mobile phone's alarm began chiming on his desk, and he looked away from the paperwork in front of him and turned it off. He sighed a little. It was 10 a.m., time to do his daily exercises. Damn, he thought to himself. 10 o'clock comes around every day, doesn't it? He got up and shut the door to his office, then opened a drawer in his desk and removed a blue racquetball. He sat back down in his chair, took the ball in his right hand in front of him, and began squeezing with all his might. Clark did all manner of other exercises in a small gym he'd built for himself in his Emmitsburg, Maryland farmhouse, but the workout he did there he actually enjoyed. His hand therapy, on the other hand, was miserable. Clark's hand had been smashed by torturers in Russia a couple of years back, and despite a half-dozen reconstructive surgeries in the intervening years, the index finger on his right hand was still both stiff and weak. Arthritis and scar tissue around the small joints of the appendage were the root cause of the problem, and his surgeon had told him he'd done all he could to repair the damage. John asked the man what John himself could do to improve his situation, and the doctor had replied with a shrug. "I'd say PT every day, to strengthen the muscles and stretch the tissue. The only problem is the arthritis in the knuckles. Working out that hand is going to hurt. Every day it will hurt." The doctor thought he was talking a senior citizen into just giving up on a full recovery and enjoying his retirement years in comfort. But the doctor didn't know John Clark. Clark had happily accepted that 10-second primer on what he needed to do to make the best of his horribly damaged hand, and since that day he'd put himself through an excruciating daily 20-minute regimen of stretching and strengthening. The doc had been correct. Yes, it hurt. A lot. Every day. And even with all the pain and suffering, Clark's trigger finger was still so non-compliant he'd taken to firing guns with his middle finger, resulting in the joke around the campus that when Clark flipped you the bird, he really meant it. But his hand had improved markedly in the months he'd been putting himself through his daily 10 a.m. torture session. He squeezed down on the ball, and white-hot flame grew in the back of his hand, and it shot up his index finger. He winced with pain, and his office door flew open. Clark quickly put the ball down and looked up at the doorway. Jack Ryan Jr. stood there with a sheet of paper clutched in his hand. There was a wide grin on his face. "Do you knock, kid?" "Sorry, John," Ryan said, but he looked too excited to mean it. Clark blew out a long sigh. "What do you have?" "Scala." When Clark did not react to this, Ryan said, "Remember the name Hazelton wrote before he died?" "Of course. Who is he?" "Hazelton said he had something to do with Prague Airport. It looked like a dead end since we couldn't find anyone by that name associated with the airport. But finally I found a guy named Karol Scala, who is a low-rung consular official in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in the Czech Republic, who works in the bureaucracy of the European Union. He operates out of an office at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs building in Prague, so I didn't see a connection. But after some more digging, I see that by appointment, he will meet traveling EU diplomats at the Customs and Immigration Office at Václav Havel Airport." Clark was impressed. He said, "Not too far of a stretch to speculate this guy gave something to Hazelton, and that was what the North Koreans were after. What might he have that interested them?" Clark knew the answer to the question he had posed. He just wanted to see if Ryan would get it as well. Ryan answered confidently, "Probably travel documentation. That's foreign ministry territory. Issuing passports, entrance visas, or other EU documentation. Scala's particular job involves preparing travel documentation for Czech diplomatic employees. This guy knows what he gave Hazelton.
which means he probably knows why someone killed Hazelton. I say we pay the man a visit. Clark stood. Let's grab the guys and then go talk to Jerry. 20 minutes later, Jerry sat in the conference room surrounded by all the campus operators. He rubbed his temples.
You want to go to the Czech Republic and find out what you can about this Scala character?
That's right, said Ryan.
Covertly or overtly?
Covertly, for sure.
Jerry looked at Clark. What do you think, John?
Clark said, I'm for it. We can send Ryan and Caruso to Prague. While they're there, the rest of us will go up to New York. I want to put some resources into learning a little more about what Sharp's global intelligence partners is up to.
Sam said, John, you know Sharp's, don't you?
I did.
You guys are old buddies?
Clark gave Driscoll a sideways glance.
I wouldn't piss on Duke Sharp's if he was on fire.
You and Mary Pat seem to feel the same about the guy. What did he do?
Duke Sharps was working for FBI's counterintelligence division right after 9/11. He was based here in Manhattan, and he was promoted to the top of the Manhattan Bureau. It was a time where we needed a lot of leadership in that job. But while everybody else saw it as their duty to stick around and work, Duke Sharps saw 9/11 as an opportunity for personal enrichment. He quit FBI, then started his own consulting company. FBI needed his expertise, so they ended up paying him several times what they had been paying him. With a shrug, Sam said,
"Sounds like capitalism."
"It gets worse. Sharp's Partners was set up to work exclusively with the federal government. But slowly, over the next few years, he started branching out into the private sector, creating new divisions and offices to assist corporations on intelligence and counterintelligence matters. His work here in New York was still first rate, from what I've been told, so the government kept their hands off. But after a while it became clear his private sector work wasn't as private sector as everyone thought it was. He got caught working for the Saudis to identify Israeli Mossad officers in New York.
Sam said, "Holy shit. Why the hell is he not in prison for that?"
Sharps claimed he thought he was doing work on behalf of a Gulf oil company, corporate intel against a rival company. He also pled ignorance that the men he was tailing were Mossad. He was hauled into hearings, but they were kept quiet for a lot of reasons.
"I'll bet," said Driscoll. "A guy with Sharps' knowledge and clearances could raise a lot of issues in an open hearing."
"Right. In the end, the government couldn't prove he was knowingly working for a foreign power. He lost all his federal contracts. President Ryan saw to that, and everyone thought Sharp's Partners would dissolve without all those contracts coming in. But a funny thing happened."
Sam shook his head in disbelief.
"He didn't need the U.S. money anymore."
"Nope.
He had parlayed his high-profile FBI gig and U.S. contracts into God knows how many foreign deals. He basically became the guy in the U.S. the bad guys call when they want agents who talk and walk just like Americans, doing operations either on American soil or under the cover of the USA.
"And no one has been able to prove anything?"
Clark shook his head.
"Not a goddamn thing. Sharps has foreign entities, and they work with other foreign entities that are set up by whatever shady government or criminal group wants to hire him. It's a foolproof system. Or at least it always has been."
Clark sneered.
"If I can find any proof that treasonous bastard has taken one single dime from some other state actor for the purpose of conducting intelligence, then I will nail his balls to the steps of the FBI building as a gift to all the hard-working men and women in government who didn't parlay their access and experience into a criminal career."
Clark was ready to go.
"We'll need today to prep, to assemble equipment, to acquire transport and a safe house in theater. I'll go down and talk to IT about getting us some access to cameras outside of Sharps' office."
Jerry said, "Okay. I agree to both operations."
Good luck, guys. Your work is cut out for you. Sharps and his people are good at what they do, and New York City is their turf. You do not tail them into subways or through any choke points, because they will spot you. Clark said, "You're right about that." Ryan understood why he got the foreign duty. With his beard and other things he had done to alter his appearance in the past few years, he was almost never recognized, even on the streets of the U.S. But in Prague, he would garner even less attention. He hated that his semi-fame had to enter into the threat matrix for each operation, but he had no one to blame but himself. Not for his fame. The fact his dad was a household name around the world was at fault there. But Jack Jr. himself had sought out a life of clandestine work, and celebrity and anonymity were polar opposites. Ryan recognized his was an unusual life. It annoyed him sometimes, but he realized he wouldn't trade it for the world. He said, "Thanks, Jerry. Maybe I shouldn't press my luck, but I'd like to request that Gavin comes with us on this." Jerry was surprised. "To Prague? Why?" "Whatever Scala's involvement in this matter, I'm thinking it likely he was doing it through back channels, and not in his official capacity in the government. It stands to reason. Sharp's global intelligence partners wasn't contracted with the Czech government, so I figure he was moonlighting if he was working with them. That might mean he used his personal phone or computer as a means of contact with someone else involved. I'm assuming we'll have to skim all the intel off of his electronic devices in order to figure out who he's been talking to. If we're to do this without him knowing we're there, then our infiltration might be time-sensitive." "What if he's erased the data?" Ryan didn't hesitate. "Oh, I'm sure he has. But I've watched Gavin work. He's a bloodhound. If there is a trace of anything, even if it's something erased, Gavin will retrieve it." Jerry thought it over. He wasn't crazy about Beery running out into the field every time the campus had a time-sensitive operation. Virtually all of their operations were time-sensitive, and there was only one IT director. Jack saw his employer's hesitancy, so he said, "Of course, I guess I could just whack Carl Scala on the head and kidnap him." It was a joke, but Jerry just raised an annoyed eyebrow. Ryan smiled. "Sorry, just kidding around. It's okay. We can go without Gavin. We'll make do." Jerry looked to Clark. He was the director of operations of the campus after all. "If I send Gavin to Prague, is that going to negatively affect your operation in New York?" Clark shook his head. "We'll need schematics on Sharps's offices, employee lists, things of that sort. Might need some security measures disabled in his building if we decide to try a sneak and peek. Beery's staff is more than competent to handle all that." "Okay." Jerry turned to Ryan and Caruso. "You can take Gavin, but only if you promise to return him the way you found him." Jack and Dom laughed. Gavin Beery was virtually the only employee of Hendley Associates who wasn't happy with the new building. Although his job title had not changed since the old place, here he had control of less than half the square footage as compared to the West Odenton campus, and to Gavin that felt like a kick in the pants. Yes, the campus was a leaner outfit now. He didn't need as much space, and Jerry had put in the money to ensure that the technology here was better than much of the equipment Gavin had used at their old address. But Gavin liked the feeling of control he had over the bigger operation. West Odenton had more computers and more personnel, and Gavin Beery had been master of it all. Since the inception of the campus many years earlier, the organization derived much of its raw intelligence by intercepting the satellite feeds beamed between the NSA building up in Fort Meade, Maryland, and the CIA building down in McLean, Virginia. To do this, a huge array of dishes were necessary on the roof of the five-story West Odenton building.
The radio waves, in addition to being hard to access, were also encrypted, so that anyone who could pull them out of the air couldn't decipher the intel. Beery and his staff got around this with state-of-the-art decryption software and the massive amounts of high-tech hardware needed to run it. But the technology had changed over the years, and now Gavin was able to access every bit of the joint worldwide intelligence communications systems intelligence networks, as well as other government networks, through a back door he developed through a virtual private network. Gone now were the dishes, the miles of cabling running up and down a communications shaft, and the mainframes used just in the decoding and decrypting process. Beery did still have a mainframe here at the Alexandria building, but he was able to task it to other projects. Gavin missed his sat dishes and his cabling. He had developed the virtual private network access to JWICS only out of necessity, after the Chinese assault on the West Odenton building meant the campus no longer had the line-of-sight access necessary to intercept the radio traffic. Gavin lamented the loss of his massive computer and communications complex, but he was the architect of the new system, and objectively he did have to admit they were now in a newer, more secure, and better connected location. But there was another reason Beery missed the big Hendley Associates building in West Odenton. Up there, they had a nice cafeteria with excellent food. Here, by contrast, they had only a break room with snack machines. Of course, there were restaurants nearby. Many of the employees walked the few blocks south down to King Street for lunch, but Gavin rarely took the time to go out for lunch. Usually he had pizza or sandwiches delivered from outside the building, but every mid-morning and mid-afternoon he liked a snack to keep him going. And for that, he had to deal with the damn machines. At 10:30 a.m., Gavin was in the little break room, dropping quarters into a snack machine. He made his selection and then groaned in frustration as his fried blueberry pie got stuck between the plexiglass window and a bag of chips. "Damn it," he said. He banged on the glass a few times to no avail, and then started to fish through his pockets for more money, deciding this to be some omen telling him he really wanted the bag of chips as well. While he was focused on his change, Jack Ryan and Dom Caruso came out of the stairwell into the break room. Jack said, "Your secretary said we'd find you here. Mid-morning munchies." "It takes a lot of fuel to power all this brain, Ryan." "Oh, I understand completely," Jack said. Dom said, "Hey, Gav, we were just wondering if you felt like taking a little trip." Gavin couldn't contain his excitement. As he spun around in surprise, several quarters flew out of his hand and bounced across the tile floor. "Hell yes! Where and when?" "Prague, and very soon, like tonight." The 56-year-old smiled broadly, and his chest heaved with excitement. "Prague. Central European intrigue. Cobblestone streets. Gas lamps. Mist. The perfect town for real cloak-and-dagger work." Jack rolled his eyes a little. "You've been reading too many spy novels. No cloak-and-dagger. More like sitting and watching, with you back at the hotel waiting for us to show up with a mobile phone or a laptop I'll need cracked."
"I can do that."
Gavin shrugged.
"It's still pretty cool."
He looked a little dejected, so Caruso added, "If it will make you feel better, you can wear a cloak in your hotel room while you do it." Ryan laughed, and Beery played along.
"Better than nothing, I guess."
Dom saw the stuck fruit pie. He punched the glass window of the machine, and the snack fell to the bottom. Pulling it out, Dom said, "Come on, Gavin. This shit will kill you." Gavin snatched the fruit pie from Dom's hand. "No, Dominic. Shooting it out with Iranians will kill you." Dom gave Beery a hard look that Ryan plainly saw. Beery realized he'd screwed up. Gavin cleared his throat uncomfortably.
"Okay, well, I'd better go tell my staff they're going to have to read an instruction manual on computers because I won't be here to hold their hands for a few days."
He took off toward the stairs. Ryan looked at his cousin.
What the hell is he talking about?
Nothing at all.
Tell me.
Clark says we have to be trained to go it alone from time to time, to keep our work compartmentalized for the good of the whole.
Something happened. I dealt with it.
Now it's time to move on. Dom winked at his cousin and slapped him on the shoulder.
But
no buts. Ryan sighed.
Okay.
Chapter 16. United Nations Resolution 1874 authorizes member states, in accordance with international law, to inspect cargo in transit to and from the Democratic People's Republic of Korea if a member state determines there are reasonable grounds to believe the cargo contains materials related to weapons of mass destruction. As with all international law, there was much gray area with this resolution, including but not limited to the types of actions that constituted suspicious behavior. And reasonable grounds could mean different things to different nations at different times, and this meant the interdiction of cargo in transit could be applied unequally in different cases. All that said, the actions of the Emerald Endeavor, a feeder max cargo ship flying the flag of Liberia and traveling in international waters due west of the city of Incheon, were without question highly suspicious, and anyone aware of UN 1874 knew that this particular resolution certainly applied to this particular situation. The Emerald Endeavor's stated cargo was sugar from Cuba, and it did originate its voyage in Havana 6.5 weeks earlier, but since then it had taken a strange route from the Caribbean. And one day out of the port of Batangas in the Philippines, the ship abruptly stopped transmitting its automatic identification system. The AIS was required on all maritime traffic of more than 300 tons. The Emerald Endeavor was 2,300 tons, so its failure to broadcast was either the result of a serious mechanical problem, or else it was a clear violation of international maritime law. Further, attempts to raise the ship via radio over the past 24 hours had been unsuccessful. It was possible the Emerald Endeavor's bridge communication system was down, but that would have been a huge problem for the captain, and the vessel steamed along in its shipping lane as if nothing were amiss, passing multiple ports of refuge as it headed north off the coast of South Korea. Any UN member state had the authority to intercept the ship by UN rules, but not every UN member state had the ability to do so. If it was indeed carrying cargo in violation of international sanctions, then the crew might well resist interdiction, either by racing away at full speed, or even by using weapons or other means to repel boarders. So a ship inclined to force compliance with UN 1874 needed to have two things in sufficient quantities before attempting the interdiction. Speed and guns. It was well past midnight now. The Emerald Endeavor was just hours from entering the territorial waters of North Korea south of the port of Haeju, and it must have seemed to the North Korean captain of the ship that he was all but home free, until the moment the large blip on his radar representing a vessel outside the shipping lanes turned and began closing on him at 45 knots, a speed impossible for a vessel of the size displayed on his screen. Unless, of course, it was a modern warship. Soon the captain learned who was after him because his radio did, in fact, work, and a Korean speaker announced, over and over, that the American naval ship USS Freedom planned on enforcing UN Resolution 1874, and the Emerald Endeavor should bring its engines to idle and prepare itself for boarding and inspection. From then on, the captain knew he would not make it to port in Haeju without a confrontation, but he did not acknowledge receipt of the message, and he did not slow.
The act of boarding and inspecting the non-compliant 2,300-ton cargo ship in transit fell to two groups of eight American men, all aged between 23 and 40. This was not a large number of men for such a daunting task, but this was Echo Platoon of SEAL Team 5, Squads Alpha and Bravo, and these guys lived for this shit. 37-year-old Chief Daryl Ricks of Chico, California, was in charge of the eight-man Alpha Squad. He and his seven special warfare operators rode in a rigged, hulled, inflatable Zodiac boat that closed on the Emerald Endeavor from astern at 38 knots. Even though the rib smashed plumes of spray as it bounced along on the black water and its motor roared, so far it had approached undetected because circling above the big cargo ship 350 yards off the rib's bow were a pair of big and loud MH-60S Seahawk helicopters. The helos had been at it for a half hour now, thumping low over the deck of the Emerald Endeavor in figure eights and swooping passes, shining spotlights on the crew on the weather deck and through the windows of the bridge. The MH-60S helicopters had two functions this morning. The first was to make a lot of noise and flash a lot of lights in order to cover for the approach of the rib at the ship's stern. And the other was to deposit the eight men of Bravo Squad on the ship's deck as soon as Chief Ricks called for them. The practice of hitting a ship at sea was called an underway boarding operation, and it was about as good as it got for a Navy SEAL. Every one of these men had not only trained for events just like this, but had also dreamt of such events, prayed for them. Their plan was straightforward. Alpha would use a grappling pole to board at the stern, and they would climb to the weather deck, then move in two four-man leapfrogging teams to the stairs of the superstructure. They would climb to the bridge while Bravo fast roped from the helo to the bow, distracting those watching from the bridge deck and using a stack of containers as cover. This would put 16 men on the ship, quickly and at multiple ingression points. Bottom up, Alpha would go for the wheelhouse, and top down, Bravo would go for the engine room. From here, both teams could detain and isolate the crew from the cargo. When that was accomplished, they would begin their own quick inspection of the cargo holds while Marines from the Freedom came over to help with the search. If any hint of contraband was found, a real inspection would take place after the ship had been towed to port in Incheon. All 16 Navy SEALs were armed with Colt M4A1 carbines outfitted with SOP mods, Special Operations Peculiar Modification Accessory Kits, essentially allowing each operator to customize his weapons platform to his preference and mission. Rix's carbine was gadget-rich. It wore a flashlight and a thermal optic and an infrared illuminator and a suppressor and a foregrip. Certainly not all the bells and whistles available with the SOP mod, but an impressive array nonetheless. Other guys in the squad had grenade launchers and lasers and variable scopes latched onto their weapons, but the rifles themselves all fired the same 5.56 round, and any operator could pick up and employ any one of his teammates' guns in a firefight if it came down to it. They wore night vision goggles on their foreheads and black balaclava masks with the image of a white jawbone on their lower portion, fortifying the men with a particularly terrifying appearance. At 200 yards, Ricks looked through the thermal scope of his rifle, scanning the aft decks. While he did so, he spoke into his headset, yelling over the noise of the engine behind him. "Bravo Actual! Alpha Actual! Two mics!" In his headset, he heard Special Warfare Operator 1, Marty Bones Hackworth, reply from up in an MH-60S flying over the cargo ship, his own transmission delivered in a yell. "Roger that, Chief! We're prepping ropes now!" And then Ricks heard the man next to him in the boat, speaking with a noticeable Dutch accent. "They know we are coming, Chief." Ricks knew Hendricks was right, and he knew this was a problem, but he just said, "Well, let's hope they're cool about it." Hendricks replied, "I still don't see why we didn't just board covertly, take advantage of total surprise. Hell, we've been telling them we're on the way for the past 4 hours." Ricks did not take his eye out of his thermoscope. Rules and shit, Hendricks. We had to give them an opportunity to let us board.
We're giving them an opportunity to shoot back.
Ricks wasn't going to argue. Hendricks liked to bitch, and normally that was okay, because if rounds did fly, Chief Ricks knew the big Dutchman with the heart of a lion would do more than his share. Ricks let him mumble and grumble a little, because it didn't affect his job, and sometimes it was pretty damn funny. But not now.
Stow it, Hendricks.
Yes, Chief.
A special warfare operator called Greaser sat in the rear next to the Navy ensign steering the rib. Greaser was a breaching specialist, but his job right now was to deploy the telescopic carbon fiber hook-on pole, from which hung a fiber light 2 assault ladder, a double-rung polyester ladder reinforced with carbon fiber poles that could take the weight of 3 operators laden for combat simultaneously. Greaser extended the pole to 6 meters in length, just high enough to reach the railing at the stern of the Emerald Endeavor, and he lifted it, along with the ladder attached to it, and waited for the rib to get into position. The Zodiac closed the last 50 yards quickly, then came along on the starboard side at the rear of the cargo ship. Greaser attached the pole hook to the railing high above, then looked down at a small computer monitor at the pole's base. It showed the view from the tiny fisheye camera at the top of the hook, and through it he could see no one on the deck aft of the superstructure who might cause trouble for the men climbing the fiber light.
"Hook on and secure!"
"Go!"
shouted Ricks, and one by one the 8 men of Alpha Squad began climbing the 20 feet up to the deck. Parnell was first, then Elizondo and Jones. When they were up and over the railing, they covered for the next 3, Takenaka, Chief Ricks, and Hendricks. Finally, Stovall and then Greaser brought up the rear. Parnell fortified the pole hook with a carabiner locking system that kept it in place. The rib below spun away and shot back into the darkness, and the 8 men broke into their 2 fire teams and split up, heading toward the 2 staircases of the superstructure. Ricks led